Scherr, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Howard Scherr. I am representing the Patent and Trademark Office in this matter. As the court knows, there are four issues presented, but the one I'd like to concentrate on primarily is the issue preclusion to begin with. This case involves a Millennium Agreement signed by the parties in January of 2001. Prior to that, and it was essentially an agreement to obtain a special pay rate, was largely at the center of this. And prior to that agreement, for 18 months leading up to October of 2000, PTO had a recruitment rate of only 53% and an attrition rate of 14%. And so the agreement was signed, and then, pursuant to the agreement, Section A2, the PTO again applied for a special rate increase with the OPM. At that point, its recruitment percentage was 97% and its attrition rate was 7%, and OPM denied the request for the special rate. And so when we got to, and then we get to 2003, where the recruitment rate is 98%, even better than 2002, and 6.3% attrition, even better than 2002. And in that year, OPM does not apply for the special rate because it thought, based on the denial in 2002, it could not certify a retention and recruitment need for 2003. But in between those two, in between the grievances of those two, there was a decision out of the second arbitration by the authority in what we call PTO1, in which the authority found that the second sentence of Section 8.2, the one that says that in the event OPM denies, then it triggers the second. There will be discussions to arrive at a substantially equivalent alternative. That sentence, they said, was unenforceable because it was not a response to any exercise of a management right, but rather the operation of law. And at the same time it made that decision, it said it rejected the union's attempt to argue that, in fact, the second sentence of Section A2 was in response to either the elimination of paper files and or the addition of a customer service element. So the authority ruled on everything in PTO1, and in particular, as I want to emphasize, found the second sentence of Section A2 unenforceable. So now we come to the third grievance, or the grievance in 2003, which is the subject of this case. And let me repeat that the agency did not apply for the increase because its statistics were even better than its statistics in 2002. And so it felt it did not have the data to make the requisite certification to OPM. So the union said to the arbitrator, and the arbitrator accepted as part of its view of the case, that they would then treat sentence one, the one that requires PTO to go to OPM for an increase. When PTO did not go, they would treat that as the same as a denial. And they moved to the second sentence in the second arbitration. And notwithstanding PTO1, the arbitrator ignored PTO1 decision and held that it was enforceable as a response to the elimination of paper files and the inclusion of a customer service element. And so our position before the authority was simply, and our position here is, the authority decided all of that in the first decision, the PTO1 decision. The arbitrator certainly could not disagree with that decision. They are bound by the decisions of the authority. And the only way the authority in the second decision purported to get around the issue preclusion concept was to say there was a different interpretation by a different arbitrator, and that was not involved in the PTO1 case. But that's the whole point of collateral estoppel. Collateral estoppel is to prevent a party from either trying to make a different case based on the same facts and issue in the first case, so as to try this argument, and then if it doesn't succeed, to make a second argument in a different setting. That's precisely the point of collateral estoppel or issue preclusion. But in fact, it turns out, the union actually did make the same arguments and didn't succeed before the arbitrator in the first arbitration. He didn't accept the notion that the second sentence or the first sentence of A2 in the Millennium Agreement was a response to the elimination of paper files and the customer service element addition. Rather, he said it was there to prevent pay erosion, which is quintessentially correct. But then he went on in the first arbitrator to hold against the agency. But as I said, the authority in PTO 1 held that there was no enforceability of the second sentence because it was a response to the operation of law, namely the OPM regulations and the statutes pertaining to special rate increases, and not anything management had done. And so that should have precluded automatically the second arbitrator from deciding anything else, and should have, as Member Beck said in dissent, controlled the disposition in this case in the second arbitration. And that should be the end of the matter.
You want to say something about the authority's argument that this collateral estoppel argument is waived because it wasn't raised?
Well, the authority didn't raise that. That was the intervener who raised
that. Sorry.
And it certainly was raised in our exceptions at 13 and 14 in the joint appendix. We raised the issue of binding precedent. And certainly the authority itself had no trouble thinking that collateral estoppel was raised. Member Beck in his dissent attributed it to our arguments. And in footnote 5, the majority addressed it and said, it's not, whatever the merits of it, or to the extent that it's raised as collateral estoppel, we reject it because this is a different arbitrator deciding essentially a different arbitration. And in our view, that is exactly why collateral estoppel should apply, that all the facts in this case are historical evidence. Everything pertaining to the meaning of Section A2 arose up to and including around January 4, 2001, when the Millennium Agreement was signed. So after that, there was no negotiation over Section A2. All the facts that you might say went into whatever the meaning was of that section had already been addressed and resolved, and there were no new facts added. The issue in the first arbitration was the enforceability of Section A2. The
Would
issue.
Would it make a difference if the authority had not adopted a collateral estoppel rule, if I can put it that way?
Well, certainly we would have then been in a position of arguing that it ought to, but it has had a collateral estoppel rule.
Well, what I'm getting at is, you know, the intervener's argument about there was no opportunity to appeal PTO 1.
Right.
And normally that would be a consideration, and your response is, well, under the Scott case, the authority has not taken that position.
Right. I think there are two points about that. Number one, even the cases, the judicial cases, which say in collateral estoppel, we look to see whether there's been judicial finality. They use that only as one factor. They don't say it's dispositive either way. But the other point here it may be an important factor, but remember here in arbitration, most of these cases don't go to the courts of appeals. 7123 has a carve-out exception for arbitration decisions.
But that's a different issue.
Well, it adds to the force of why the authority's collateral estoppel theory or doctrine ought to apply, especially in arbitration settings.
So the argument is not only that in fact there was a ruling on the key issue here that was binding both on the second arbitrator and the authority, but under the authority's own collateral estoppel doctrine, it was bound to apply that doctrine.
Yes, and I think Member Beck himself espouses that view. In any event, what we tried to say is make a twofold argument. One, the issue preclusion argument.
Could I just?
Yes, Judge Rogers, I'm sorry.
The authority and how it operates is a little different than a number of entities. And as you say, there are all these arbitrations that come up, and I'm just wondering if there is any play in the joints here. Because of the nature of what's coming before the authority. And it's really up to the authority as to whether or not it wants to say, we're bound by that previous ruling.
Well, so two things about that. One is they definitely have a collateral estoppel doctrine that they apply, and they didn't explain why, other than the reasons I gave you, why either it shouldn't apply in arbitration or in these settings. It hasn't expounded its view on that. And the other is that, in fact, the authority has, I think, failed generally to explain why it shouldn't apply here. I don't know that there's play in the joints, and I think it's especially relevant in arbitration matters because there, for the most part, You don't necessarily, in very few of the cases, do you ever get judicial review of the arbitration decision. But here, by the way, we also, I think the second part of my argument would have been, I should say, even if it's not issue preclusion, it's a precedent that the authority typically finds itself bound by, unless it explains why, in a cogent way, why it shouldn't be bound by the decision. And here, the only reason the authority gave was in note 5, that this is a different arbitration. And that can't be right because, number one, arbitrators are bound by authority decisions. So it had to tangle with why it wasn't the case that the second arbitrator was bound by the decision in PTO 1, and we don't have any real elucidation of that theory by the authority. We cited the Morgan case from the Federal Circuit. That's an MSPB case, not exactly the same as I think you're suggesting, Judge Rogers, is the Federal Labor Relations Authority, but it works in the same personnel setting. And the Federal Circuit has found that collateral estoppel binds the MSPB, and that if the MSPB doesn't apply it in appropriate situations, it's reversible error. And it did, in the Morgan case, find it reversible error not to apply collateral estoppel, and that was a case where the first decision by the MSPB was only an MSPB decision. There was no judicial review of that decision. So it seems to me that consistency in authority decisions and the way the authority has used collateral estoppel in the past or issue preclusion ought to apply here, and that there is no appropriate rationale for circumventing it in this case.
The intervener also cites our case NAGE, saying that, you know, the mere fact that a dissenting member raises the issue is not enough.
Right. So the fact of the matter is it wasn't just the dissenting member. But that in NAGE, I think the court made the point that there might be other arguments raised when the authority raises a matter sua sponte, and that therefore you can't automatically say that the party who wants to invoke collateral estoppel, all of their arguments or their arguments would have been presented to the authority. But here I have 2 points. Number one, the majority did respond to Member Beck, whose full argument is essentially the argument we make here. And the authority didn't say it didn't have an opportunity to pass on the collateral estoppel.
Well, the intervener's argument is, well, it never had an opportunity to argue and put its position before the authority.
Then it should have sought reconsideration, it seems to me, on that matter. But in fact, binding precedent was the argument we made in our exceptions, and we made the argument that PTO 1 has determined all the issues presented in this case, and that was in our exceptions. I'm talking about JA 21, and I would also cite the court to JA 115 and 116, which was our presentation to the arbitrator, in which we said, as noted in PTO 1, blah, blah, blah. So it certainly is the situation that the issue was presented, and I want to emphasize the authority believes that it has been presented to it and that it's had a full opportunity to pass on that argument. I'd like, if there are no further questions, I'd like to save my remainder for rebuttal.
All right. Ms. Koppel?
May it please the Court, I'm Rosa Koppel, representing the respondent Federal Labor Relations Authority. First, I would like to address the issue preclusion matter. In the authority's view, PTO 1 did not preclude the authority or arbitrator Arrigo from finding that Section A2 is an arrangement. As PTO agrees, arbitrator Arrigo was not bound by any fact findings that arbitrator Evans did or did not make, or by arbitrator Evans' contract interpretation. Thus, arbitrator Arrigo was free to make his own findings and contract interpretations.
What about the authority's decision in PTO 1?
Well, the authority in PTO 1 was
the
what they were doing.
Was the arbitrator bound by that?
No, the second arbitrator was not, because in PTO 1, as in this case, what the authority was doing was not reviewing Section A2 in a vacuum and doing its own independent interpretation. Instead, it was reviewing different awards of arbitrators. And when it reviews...
Well, how do you reconcile that with the authority's own doctrine of collateral estoppel?
The authority's... the requirements of the authority's collateral estoppel doctrine is that its prior decision must address and have litigated the same issue that is before the authority in the subsequent decision. And the authority and PTO 1 and here addressed different issues because they were determining whether different arbitration awards were contrary to law. And those arbitration awards were different. They interpreted A2 in different ways. And more importantly, perhaps, arbitrator Arrigo made a factual finding that there was a direct linkage between A2 and the agency's paper file reduction and critical and the customer service element initiatives, while arbitrator Evans did not make a factual finding on that. And the authority, when it's reviewing an arbitrator's award, must defer to the factual findings that the arbitrator makes. Different factual findings were made here, and that caused the authority to reach different results as to whether or not A2 was an arrangement. In fact, if the court were to find collateral estoppel here, the effect would be that arbitrator Arrigo would have been bound by arbitrator Evans' failure to decide whether or not there was a link between A2 and
the
paper
file. Wouldn't he have just been bound by the authority's decision in PTO1?
I'm sorry?
Wouldn't he have just been bound by the authority's decision in PTO 1?
Only if that decision concerned the same issue, and
well,
it's our position.
That's my point. It was the same issue.
It is not the same issue, Your Honor, because the issue is not whether A2 is an appropriate arrangement. It's whether the award that the authority reviewed was contrary to law. So the authority, in reviewing different awards, this concerned, as we explained in our decision,
I don't understand that. In PTO1, the authority said it was not a special arrangement, and it rejected the argument that this was sort of compensation for whatever that stuff was. And in the second case, the authority reached exactly the opposite conclusion.
But in both cases, when the authority made its findings, it said, based as interpreted by the arbitrator.
But the first arbitrator, under collateral estoppel, the second arbitrator was bound by the authority's first decision.
Your Honor, it's our position that they were not because different issues were, the same issue was not involved. The authority was reviewing different arbitrator awards that had different fact findings. And when the authority decides on whether a provision is an appropriate arrangement, they must defer to the factual findings made by the arbitrator. Arbitrators can reach different factual findings, as is what happened here, and that explains why the authority reached different results.
It just isn't clear to me why that is so, candidly. I mean, I hear the words you're saying to Judge Tatel or to all of us, but I just don't understand.
Okay, I will. When the authority reviews an arbitrator's award.
I understand. Different arbitrators make different factual findings. And your argument is even though the authority in PTO1 had affirmed the arbitrator's findings in PTO1, the second arbitrator was not bound by the first arbitrator's fact findings.
That's correct.
And I gather also not bound by the authority's decision to affirm the first arbitrator's fact findings,
which was an
interpretation of the issue that was before the second arbitrator.
But again, the authority is bound by whatever factual findings are made or not made by the arbitrator. The arbitrator did not have an opportunity to determine whether there was linkage between A2 and the agency actions, because that was not an issue before that arbitrator. Here, arbitrator Arrigo did make that factual finding, and that factual finding that there was a linkage was key to the issue as to whether or not A2 was an arrangement. And the authority cannot interpret contract provisions in a vacuum. They determine whether they're enforceable based on the arbitrator's interpretation and findings of fact, and if those are different.
So it wasn't a necessary implicit finding by the first arbitrator? I mean, you don't get to the second sentence until you fail to do the first sentence.
The first arbitrator did not address the first arbitrator found that there was the first arbitrator just did not have an opportunity to determine whether there was a link between A2 and the paper files and customer service elements.
But he said that the union hadn't presented enough evidence on that.
But he did not make a finding. The arbitrator did not say there was no linkage. He just did not make any finding. The first arbitrator just didn't make any finding at all.
The union had failed to show.
Now, I'm sorry, you're talking about PTO-1 or the first arbitrator's decision?
PTO-1 and the first arbitrator.
PTO-1 said the, but PTO-1 specifically said that arbitrator Evans did not make a finding one way or another.
Even though he found that the union hadn't presented enough evidence.
But the authority did not in PTO-1 make a particular finding that there was no linkage. It just said that there was, it didn't address it because the arbitrator made no finding. And therefore, the authority could not address whether or not there was a linkage. While in this decision, arbitrator Arrigo made a factual finding that there was a linkage. So, in the authority in deciding that A2 was an arrangement had to defer to that fact, and that's why different results were reached, and that's why there's no issue preclusion here. The second.
Do you agree that under the authority's collateral estoppel doctrine, it's irrelevant whether there's an opportunity for judicial review?
We didn't address that argument in our brief, but it could well be a plausible argument, and counsel for POPA will have an opportunity to address that. But we felt we did not need to address that because we found here clearly that there were different issues involved. And when different issues are involved in authority decisions, under our collateral estoppel doctrine, there is no collateral estoppel. Next,
So the authority's interpretation is that unless there is an affirmative finding by an arbitrator,
there must be a finding. There simply was no finding by this arbitrator.
Well, what did the arbitrator mean when he said there wasn't enough evidence?
And PTO-1 made that statement. In PTO-1, the authority found that there wasn't enough evidence, but the arbitrator found that this was an arrangement because arbitrator Evans found that the agency had breached A2 because they did not complete their discussions as to a substantially equivalent alternative. Arbitrator Evans did not address the issue of whether there was linkage between A2 and the agency's actions because that matter was just, that was not an issue that was before him. If there are no further questions on issue conclusion, I'd like to address appropriate arrangement if there's time for that.
You're out of time. Why don't you take a minute?
Okay. The authority in finding that A2 was an appropriate arrangement adopted or used the abrogation standard, which the authority had reinstated last year in EPA, and that applying that standard was a reasonable interpretation of the statute. And in applying it, both in this case and EPA, the authority took a careful look at the statute and found that it made clear distinctions between the authority's review of an agency allegation that a proposal is non-negotiable and the review of whether an arbitration award is contrary to law. And based on the different language that the statute uses for those types of review, the authority found that it was appropriate to apply the excessive interference standard when looking at whether a proposal is non-negotiable and the abrogation standard when determining whether an arbitration award is enforceable.
All right.
No further questions.
Thank you. Mr. Hume.
May it please the court, I'm Richard Hearn for the Patent Office Professional Association. I intended to focus on two issues this morning. Number one, why we don't believe this interferes with the right to retain employees in the first place, and also the profound consequences of the PTO's claim that contractually bargained for benefits are not covered by the Back Pay Act. But first, I really think I need to clarify what happened in that first arbitration case and why collateral estoppel does not apply. I tried that first case, I tried both cases, and here's what happened. At the first arbitration hearing, the PTO never argued that the Millennium Agreement violated management's rights to retain employees. The PTO, because the issue was never raised at the hearing, we never presented or argued or presented any evidence as to why it was an appropriate arrangement. Only on page 22 of the agency's post-hearing closing brief did they make a passing reference argument in one paragraph that this affects the right to retain employees. It was such a half-hearted argument that arbitrator Evans dismissed it with a one-sentence footnote. But because the issue of the impact of management's rights was not raised at the hearing, we had no opportunity or reason whatsoever to present what would essentially be an affirmative defense that it was an appropriate arrangement.
So you heard counsel say, well, you should have filed a motion for reconsideration.
We filed a motion reconsideration of which case? Of the second?
First. They put it in their post-decision exceptions. You heard my question.
Right.
You heard his answer.
Yes, you cannot file the motion for reconsideration in arbitration. You don't, that the arbitrators do not entertain motions for reconsideration in arbitration. That is not part of the arbitration process.
So when you got before the
authority, they first raised they fleshed out the issue of the right to retain employees. We said it wasn't, but one needs to read the PTO decision very carefully. The FLRA said, based on the record before us, okay, there is no demonstration that this is an appropriate arrangement. And that's logical because it wasn't an issue in the first case. I had no reason to present what would be essentially an affirmative defense when there was no claim at the hearing that it interfered with management's rights to retain employees. And as far as the binding effect of PTO 1, the authority repeatedly says it qualifies in PTO 1 its decision, because every sentence where they say make the ruling, they qualify by saying, in this case, as interpreted and applied by this arbitrator. And that's the extent of the finding. But notwithstanding the fact that this was not even an issue litigated in the first case, it is true that the PTO never raised collateral estoppel or issue preclusion in its exceptions in PTO 2. Even Member Beck noted that the PTO never used the phrase collateral estoppel.
They said there was binding precedent.
That's not the same thing as collateral estoppel. Mm-hmm. And we also need to keep in mind that in arbitration decisions are not precedential. Okay. And we attempted, and if the court may recall, we attempted to, but could not obtain judicial review of the decision in PTO 1. And that is another reason why collateral estoppel doesn't apply.
Doesn't that just mean that it wouldn't collaterally estop us? It has nothing to do with whether it collaterally stops the authority.
Well, we would never have gotten here then. In other words, that's where we are today. So, I mean, I guess it opens up the door. If this court's not collateral estoppel doesn't apply at this stage, then it becomes a moot issue.
What?
If collateral estoppel, even if supposing collateral estoppel.
Whether the board is collaterally estopped.
If it was, then we would have, then they said, okay, collateral estoppel applies, but then since it's not binding in this court, we would have had the right to appeal, and we'd land up in the same place anyway. So whether collateral, and what we, and I would like to also focus on what we tried to appeal in the first case.
They did argue in their exceptions. They didn't just argue that this was a binding precedent. They also argued they were the same parties. You don't have to make that argument to make a precedential argument. That's only relevant if you're
arguing. Well, at most, they argued it by implication. In fact,
they said it. They said very clearly, same parties. That wasn't implication.
That does not mean, that does not necessarily follow the collateral estoppel.
Well, the board understood it as a collateral estoppel argument. I mean, the authority.
Collateral estoppel has a lot of other issues. And we would have, right. And had it been raised,
They said same parties, same issues. That's what collateral estoppel is.
And actually,
and that's
litigated.
What the board understood. The board said, to the extent that the agency's exceptions can be construed as the arbitrator was collaterally estopped, we reject that.
Can be construed, but the jurisprudence requires it to be explicitly argued. And in fact, in this court, in Department of...
See, this is a jurisprudential issue.
You can't raise an exception by implication, and this court has ruled that in both FLRA and NLRB decisions.
You're completely right about that. The question is, well, what's the implication here? It seems like they made the argument and that the authority said, to the extent it be construed as such.
To the extent it could be construed doesn't sound like a clear exception to me. That just sounds like an implication. But I don't think that the court doesn't even need to get to collateral estoppel if the court looks at the issue of whether the Millennium Agreement affects the management's rights to retain employees in the first place. We believe the authority incorrectly held that a contract provision that has the effect of encouraging employees to remain employed is unenforceable because virtually any contractual bargaining provision that benefits employees will have that effect. In fact, the authority has previously held in numerous cases that such provisions, such as those mandating daycare centers, government housing, access to military exchange privileges, are negotiable precisely because they retain employees. And in another line of cases, the authority weighs employee retention as a positive factor in determining whether proposals that ostensibly impact management's right to determine its budget are negotiable or not. The authority's finding that this interferes with the right to retain employees cannot be reconciled with its decision in NTEU 37147, in which it held that a proposal that would require the IRS to seek special pay rates was in fact negotiable. Now, the authority wouldn't consider that argument in PTO 2 saying we didn't file exceptions. But we could not have filed exceptions because under 7122, you can only file exceptions to an arbitrator's award, with which we had no dispute, not an arbitrator's reasoning. And in fact, the FLRA has repeatedly says they review awards, not an arbitrator's reasoning.
All right. We've got your argument, Mr. Hume. You're over your time.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. How much time does Mr. Scher have? All right. Why don't you take two?
Thank you, Your Honor. As the latter points that Mr. Hearn raised, of course, those were the things that the authority said weren't properly before it. But I do want to make it clear that we're not talking here about a factual interpretation by one arbitrator and then a second. Excuse me. But rather, the enforceability of Section 8(2), Sentence 2. And that enforceability is a question of law that the authority decides. And it decided in PTO 1 that it was unenforceable, and that should end the question. Then with respect to this question of facts and different facts, I just want to point out that the paragraph that starts although in PTO 1 that goes from page 842 to 843 is the key. There's the sentence or paragraph where the authority addresses in PTO 1 what was before the arbitrator and in addition says, we don't even think the second sentence permits the interpretation that this was in response to management's elimination of paper files or the addition of a customer service element. But more importantly, I think, is the statement by both the second arbitrator and the authority in the second decision at page 62 of the joint appendix, and then page 285 is the authority's decision. The essential facts and circumstances of this case are the same as the first case. And therefore, it seems to me there is an ounce of argument that can be made that the two cases shouldn't be, the second case shouldn't have been bound by the first decision, or issue preclusion shouldn't have applied in the second case. POPA did have an opportunity to argue this collateral estoppel argument at what point, or at least a semblance of it. I point you to joint appendix at 145 to 146. And based on the theory I think the authority is presenting here, that continuous arbitrators can render continuously different decisions, even though there's an intervening FLRA decision that would ordinarily bind it, would just allow unions to keep looking for different arbitrators and try to present what they would consider different evidence to get a different result. Seems to me that's inappropriate, but of course not the situation here, because we do have the intervening decision of the authority. I see that my time is up. I thank the court.
Thank you.